and you're listening to 91.7 FM WHUS. I am Fran Storch, and this is Radio Naturopath. It's a call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, and this is my co-host, Ron Meniza.
Good morning, Dr. Storch.
If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine, you can call us at 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you can't listen to the whole show at this time, you can listen to us on podcasts, and there's a number of ways to do that. You can go right to whus.org, or you can go to my Facebook page or my Twitter account, at Fran Storch ND. I also have an Instagram at Fran Storch ND. So you can listen any of those ways. So we'd love to hear from you, and we'd love for you to listen at any time. And we are recording the show as we speak, so you can don't feel like you have to listen to the whole thing now. Woohoo! All right. So happy spring. Last week was the spring equinox, and it is now spring, which is really exciting.
Yeah, we're anxiously awaiting it.
Yeah, kind of, sort of. That's right.
I mean, it is spring chronologically. It's spring.
Yeah, the temperature's going to go up a little bit in the next couple of days, which will be nice.
That'd be nice.
Yeah, and so so there's a lot of things that are going around that. I mean, we are going to see some high 50s, low 60s in the next couple of days. And I did hear tell that some people were hearing peepers. I have not heard peepers in Connecticut yet. And usually by this time, I have heard them at least once, but I have not heard any at all, and we're already at March 28th. And there have been years when I've heard peepers on March 13th, on St. Patrick's Day, not this year. Down in Jersey, they have. Down in Jersey, they've definitely heard them, but nope, not up here. They're still freezing in those little ponds. So hopefully by next week, we will have heard some peepers. All right. Anyway, so I wanted to do a couple things. The first thing I wanted to do was emulate you and start it with a rant.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm going to rant.
Rant's rant of the week? Yeah. Fran's rant of the week.
Yeah, the Fran rant.
The Fran rant.
That has a ring to it.
Or it could be a frant.
Oh, that hurt.
Oh, I know.
A frant.
I know. I had to go there, though.
There are so many things you could do with Fran. And, you know, one of the things I do is, I put my name into songs like, I'm the Fran, I'm a Fran, and I can't help but love you. So, and I do that. And, The jig is up, the news is out, blah, 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 for the wanted Fran.
Right.
Do that too.
Right.
Yeah.
I know. I Fran you a lot.
Franberry fruitcake.
Right.
Franorama.
You're fantastic.
Fantastic. I know.
I know.
Yeah. 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 And, and I often get called Fran Tarkenton. Not so much anymore because people, you know, this
wow,
generation.
Wow, that goes way back.
I know. But when I was a kid, they used to call me that. So,
really?
Yeah, anything you can do to rhyme with Fran or portmanteau Fran into something else, it happens.
So, frant away.
Port frantau. Oh, that just hurt.
Just. So, what's your frant this morning?
So, my frant is about IUDs or intrauterine devices.
Oh, boy, this should be interesting.
Yeah, so this is the interesting thing. So, first of all, do you know what an intrauterine device is?
It's a birth control device.
That is right. It's a contraceptive device. That's right. So the main two types of intrauterine devices or IUDs that are available right now are they are hormone containing or made from copper. So there's a couple of brands, like for example, Mirena and Skyla, both contain levonorgestrel. So they contain a progestin, a synthetic progesterone, which is not progesterone and doesn't behave like natural progesterone. And they also can contain just copper. So the Paragard is a copper IUD, and there may be other brands of those too. But anyway, those are the two main kinds. So IUDs are interesting in the way that they work. Now, women can find them, or couples can find them, to be very convenient because they do effectively prevent conception. But the way they work is kind of weird. The history of the IUD is that back in thousands of years ago, someone figured out that, first of all, if you want to transport stuff across the desert, camels are good because camels don't need a lot of water, and camels are strong, and they work effectively as beasts of burden, and they can be reasonably calm enough, not always, but reasonably. But anyway, it's kind of inconvenient if your camel gets pregnant, then it's not going to be so interested in schlepping stuff across the desert because it's schlepping a baby. So somebody said, hey, what if we take the camel and we put a stone in its uterus? Maybe it won't conceive. And guess what? It worked. And there was the first intrauterine device.
Really?
Yeah.
So, a stone?
So how does an intrauterine device work?
I'm dying to hear this.
Yeah. So first of all, your uterus doesn't like to have very much in it. In order for you to grow a baby inside you, and this is for you women, not so much for you guys, but in order to grow a baby inside you, you need to make a constellation of hormones that keep your uterus from rejecting the baby. And if you don't have adequate hormones that way, you will reject the baby. And that's why miscarriages are fairly common. If there's anything wrong with the hormonal picture or with the genetics of the growing fetus, or zygote or embryo or whatever stage it's at, it will be rejected. So in order for it to stay in, there has to be hormones present to make that happen. Now, if you insert a foreign object into the uterus, body doesn't really like that. And some people can't do IUDs because as soon as you put them in there, the body is going to say, no, you can't put something in there. So you women who have had periods before, which is most of you, women, you know that sometimes when you have your period, you get cramping. And one of the reasons you get cramping, you'll get more cramping if you have any blood clotting. You'll get blood clotting during your menses if you have a heavy flow. When you flow quickly, you tend to get more clots because your body's like, whoa, it's coming out too fast. Let's clot some of that stuff. So if you get clots, now you have a solid object in the uterine canal. And as I said, the uterus doesn't really like to have anything in it. So it sees that solid object and it's going to cramp around it to try to expel it. So in the meantime, if you leave something in there long enough, the uterine lining becomes irritated. And so if you put a stone in there or an IUD or anything at all, the uterus will become inflamed. It won't become inflamed if you are growing an embryo into a fetus. Because you have lots and lots of progesterone that prevents that from happening. But if you have an IUD, you're kind of hoping that the uterus isn't going to become too inflamed to expel the IUD and give you bad cramping. Some women can't tolerate the IUD because that is exactly what happens. A lot of women can. They don't get enough cramping to make it a problem. So there are two ways that they do the IUD. One is to imbue it with levonorgestrel. And the IUDs, by the way, are generally implanted for 5 years. They have enough hormone in them to slowly release for 5 years or enough copper in them to slowly release for 5 years. And then they're taken out and the woman can decide, does she want to have a new one placed or not? Or if she wants to conceive, it can come out. So the first one, the IUD that contains levonorgestrel, this synthetic progestin, the way it works is it sends out that hormone and it blocks progesterone receptors. And so your natural progesterone can't bond nearly as well. So progesterone, listen to the sound of the word. Progesterone means progestation. It's a hormone that maintains pregnancy. So if you use levonorgestrel, which blocks progesterone receptors, it works a little bit like progesterone, but a lot it doesn't. It makes the uterine lining inhospitable for implantation. Plus, you have that object in there, which works the same way as that stone in the camel's uterus, which caused that little bit of inflammation. So now the uterine lining is inhospitable for implantation, and now you have a successful IUD that's preventing conception. Okay, so but the only issue is now you have progestin in that uterine lining, and you have some of it going into the general circulation, and for it to and because when you have one thing that happens is sometimes women stop getting their periods because they have this higher level of hormone in their bodies, and their bodies say, okay, the progesterone or progestin isn't low enough for me to have menses, so they'll just stop getting their periods. That doesn't happen to everyone. Some people, because the uterine lining is irritated, they get periods and they're really bad. They're very crampy and they have a lot of excessive flow. So that's another thing that can happen. And that can happen also with the copper IUD, just because there's a foreign object in there, body doesn't like it. So when you do get your menses, it's a painful process. Mind you, there are women who get IUDs and they're just fine with them. They last for 5 years. They prevent conception. The woman doesn't have to think about additional in-the-moment contraception, and it works fine. Of course, the thing you have to remember is that IUDs all by themselves do not prevent sexually transmitted diseases. So if you are not monogamous with a partner with whom you have both been completely tested for sexually transmitted diseases, then you need to use a barrier method anyway. So that's really important to know. So here's what my rant is about. Not too long ago, I had a few women come in who had been given IUDs while nursing. And that makes me nuts. All right.
Why would you give someone an IUD while nursing?
Because their practitioner is saying to them, you can get pregnant, and you can get pregnant while you're nursing, and you don't want that to happen. That would be a bad thing.
Isn't that less likely when you're nursing?
Yes, it is less likely. It's not impossible, but it is less likely.
Okay.
Yes, because prolactin is a hormone that comes from your pituitary gland, and it promotes the production of milk. And prolactin suppresses menstruation. It absolutely does. And nature is very kind that way, in that if you're nursing, you've got this prolactin on board, and prolactin will suppress your menstruation. Because do you really want to get pregnant while you're nursing a baby? Having said that, it is still possible for you to conceive while
mm-hmm.
you're pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what I meant. While you're nursing. Still possible to conceive while you're pregnant. That's a tautology, I think.
That
anyway,
would,
so.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's a tautology. Maybe it's not the right definition. But anyway, so you can conceive while you have... While you're nursing. It's not impossible. It depends on your prolactin levels, and it depends on how fertile you are. And sometimes just the FSH and LH, the hormones that cause ovulation, they don't care if you have a lot of prolactin on the board. But if you're exclusively nursing, and you're nursing a lot, and you're not too stressed out, you probably are going to suppress your menses for a while. If you get to a point where you're not nursing as much, then you're going to have less prolactin, your milk flow is going to slow down, and you may get to a point where you have enough hormone to get a cycle again. So what'll happen is some practitioners will say to their patients that if you don't want to conceive, one good way to prevent that is to get an IUD. And if the IUD has levonorgestrel in it, that makes no sense to me, because first of all, the levonorgestrel isn't going to just stay in the uterus. It is going to get to some extent into the general circulation. Do you really want levonorgestrel in your baby? Because some of it's going to get into the breast milk. Does that make sense? That's number one. The other thing is, one of the things that happens with women, some women get something called postpartum depression.
Mm-hmm.
So postpartum depression, some women, and they're going to tend to get postpartum depression, particularly if their pregnancy was stressful and if they are stressed. If they're stressed to start with, if they're depressed or anxious anyway, and sometimes it just happens regardless. But those women generally are very sensitive to progesterone. And the hormone that you make in spades when you're pregnant is progesterone. Progesterone does a bunch of cool stuff. Progesterone is a wonderful anti-inflammatory. Progesterone makes you feel good. That pregnancy glow partially comes from progesterone. Progesterone makes you feel really mellow and chill. And it makes you feel really good. So some women... When you give birth, you no longer need to maintain a pregnancy, because one of the main function of progesterone is progestation. It maintains the uterine lining and it maintains the pregnancy, and it makes it so that the uterus doesn't expel the baby. It relaxes you. It relaxes the uterine lining. It relaxes the uterus so that you can grow a baby. That's what it's for. So you don't need so much anymore. So you don't have a placenta making spades of progesterone, because you release the placenta when you give birth, which is a reason why, wait for it, some women take their placenta and...
they eat it.
Yes.
Yeah, I've heard this.
Yes, they take the placenta and they make a broth out of it. They make a soup out of it and they eat it. Why? And I know that to some people that's going to sound gross, but it... If you take out the gross from it, it makes scientific sense.
Okay.
It's very nutritious. It's a placenta. It's sending all this nutrition, these vitamins and minerals to the baby. Everything that you eat and all the wonderful nutrients that come through your body are going through that placenta to get into the baby. So if you eat it, it's going to be a very nutritious thing. And you just had a baby and that placenta just came out of you. So if you consume it, now you're going to continue to get some of the nutrition from the placenta. And if you're nursing, guess where it's going to go? It's going to go to baby too. The other thing is it's going to have some progesterone in it. And so you're going to be less likely to have postpartum depression.
Wow.
So it's not, I mean, I know it sounds gross because it almost sounds like cannibalism.
I was just going to say it has a little cannibalistic twist to it.
What are you going to do with it instead?
Well, they're just going to toss it out.
Right. And some people ceremonially bury it.
Mm-hmm.
But my opinion, again, I know that some people are going to think it's gross. I don't know that it's kosher. I don't know if it's halal. But if you get, if you push out that stuff out of the way.
Well,
very,
it's not kosher.
Well, very wise women. You know, through the ages, wise women, herbalists and doulas and people who assist women with birth, midwives, through the ages have recommended it because it makes sense. Scientifically, it completely makes sense.
Okay.
All right. So,
Have you ever known anyone to do this?
I think so. I'm not 100%. I think so. I'm not sure. But if a woman came into my practice and said, I ate my placenta, we made a wonderful broth out of it, stew, I've still got it. I made bone broth and I put the placenta in it. I would be like, you go, girl. That's what I would be. I would be like, that's a wonderful thing. And I would, I would give her this same speech. This is a really good thing. Nutritionally, if you take out the weird, gross, spiritual, whatever, scientifically, purely scientifically, it makes sense. And there are some spiritual reasons why it makes sense, too, because you're reconnecting with yourself. You're reconnecting with the baby. And, you know, in the spirit of using, you know, when you kill an animal for food and then you go ahead and you're spiritual about it and you honor the animal and then you use every part of the animal, it's kind of like that. You're putting the placenta to use, to its final use, and you're actually reincorporating it into you and the baby. I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, you may think it's weird, but I don't think it's a bad thing. So I'm ranting about the IUD. You're going to go ahead and then put a progestin-laden IUD into a woman who potentially could have postpartum depression, or if it's a woman who already has problems with anxiety and depression, then you're going to go ahead and put a progestin IUD into her. And the progestin blocks progesterone receptors. It makes no sense. And I've seen this done, that women who are nursing are given progestin-containing IUDs. I don't agree with that because the progestin is going to block that woman's progesterone receptors. And she's going to go from all this progesterone to tank. And it doesn't make sense. So I don't think it's a good practice. The other piece that I have talked to women about is that you place this thing in the uterus. The uterus has just undergone a major event, and it kind of has to heal. So then you're going to go put something in there that one of the ways that it works is to inflame the uterine lining. Doesn't make sense to me.
No.
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 Right, because the uterine lining is already inflamed, it's already irritated, it already had a baby in there, and then the baby came out, and now it has to redo it. But do you know that the uterus, if you ever see a woman who has just given birth, do you think her belly goes from being way out here to flat in a day?
Not any I've seen.
No, exactly. So how big do you think that uterus is?
It's probably still swollen.
It's very large.
Yeah.
Yes, it's swollen or stretched
or
out
stretched
anyway.
Out, right.
And so it takes a while for everything to go back to a smaller size.
Mm-hmm.
And a uterus that has had a baby in it is going to be bigger than a uterus that has never had a baby in it.
So what's the recommended time period that you would wait until you were to use something like an IUD?
Well, first of all, my opinion is that it shouldn't be used while you're nursing.
At all?
No.
Ever?
No.
Okay.
Because you have to be careful because you have to remember anything that goes into your body while you're nursing, you have to assume that it's going to get into your baby or your child. Some women nurse until 3 years old, right?
It can happen.
It has happened. Didn't it happen to you?
Yes.
Yes. So, mm-hmm. right. And I'm, you know, so... And that's perfectly normal. And I always tell my women patients that, you know, nursing is an agreement between you and your child, and you do it for as long as you both feel like you want to do it. I mean, I personally might feel weird about someone who is nursing at 7, but who am I? You don't usually see that, though. What you usually see is either the mom or the child decides at some point that they're done. And, you know, usually it's an agreement between the two of them that there's and little kids really like to nurse. If the woman is comfortable with nursing, little kids love it. They ask for it. They want to do it. Once they are able to ask for it, they ask for it. They find it very comforting and very lovely. And then if you continue to nurse your child after they are able to talk, they will tell you how much they love it. And it's really sweet where you hear children talking about nursing and how wonderful it is. There's probably, I wonder if there's YouTubes on that where children talking about how great it is to nurse. Anyway, so while you're nursing, it does not make sense for a mom to have a progestin-containing IUD in, because I'm concerned that the uterus is going to, it's not going to be able to heal as well. You're having this fake hormone in that shouldn't be there, where the mom is already tanked on progesterone and stressed, and mom needs the extra progesterone because she's stressed now. She's taking care of a new baby, and who knows what else she's got going on in her life. So can you get pregnant while nursing? Yes, you can. Are you as likely to get pregnant when you're nursing? No, you're not. But if you feel like you need to use contraception, that's a time when you're better off using non-chemical methods. No patches, pills, IUDs, creams, anything. It's better if you want to use something to protect you against pregnancy, you need to use barrier methods. Should you have sex while you're nursing? Absolutely. Should you have sex? Absolutely. Right. Sex is good for you.
No arguments here.
Yes. Sex should be had early and often. Yeah. So, within reason.
I mean,
you don't want young kids having sex before they're really ready to, of course. But, you know, if a woman wants to have sex when she's pregnant, I think she should have sex. And if a woman wants to have sex while she's nursing, she should have sex. It's fine. Yeah. It's good for her. It's going to make her happy. It's going to make everyone happy. So sex makes you happy, generally. I mean, unless there are issues. But in and of itself, sex is a good thing. You heard it here.
Oh, we did. We heard an earful.
So that's my rant. The IUD, my opinion is that best not to use IUDs while nursing, especially if the mother is prone to or has a history of postpartum depression. Makes no sense.
Wow.
I have treated women's postpartum depression. That's the other thing. But here's corollary of the rant number two. Women get postpartum depression. Why do you think they're getting postpartum depression? Well, of course, it can be stress. There can be all kinds of reasons. They can be predisposed to depression. But if the woman was less depressed or not so depressed during her pregnancy, and then suddenly she is depressed immediately after the pregnancy, wouldn't you stop to think that maybe it's the progesterone? I have had women with bad postpartum depression, and I can give low dose natural progesterone in cream or orally below a certain dose because it's over the counter. You can go to health food stores and get natural progesterone under a certain amount. Higher amounts you have to get prescribed. So for postpartum depression, one thing that happens is women get given SSRIs. They get given antidepressant medication, which, again, doesn't make sense to me, especially if they're nursing. If the problem is that their progesterone has tanked, why not replace the progesterone? I had a couple of women come in who were prone to depression, who told me they had gotten horrible postpartum depression. They were still depressed. I would measure their progesterone, and then I would give them a little natural progesterone. Guess what happened?
They felt better.
They're happier.
Yeah. So, you know,
this is not rocket science.
At least 1 in 7 women have this. And
postpartum depression.
Yeah, and they say up to new findings are finding up to 20% of women who have a baby have postpartum depression.
Well, if they're in the industrial world, it's not surprising to me. If you're living a natural life in a tribe, you're probably not going to get postpartum depression. And why might that be? Because you're going to have a baby. First, you're going to have a baby. You're going to have a midwife. You're going to have women, lots of women around you supporting you in your pregnancy and in your birth. After you give birth, you're going to have a doula at least a doula, and you're going to have you're going to have aunts and moms and cousins and all kinds of people coming over and helping you with your pregnancy, and you're not going to have to do it all by yourself. If you live in industrialized society and you're not wealthy, you're anything but the 1%. Well, and even the 1% can get postpartum depression. I shouldn't say that, because any woman can get postpartum depression.
It can affect anyone.
That's true. But if you have to, if you have other children, or if you have a job, or if you have, you just have a life, you have life responsibilities, and you have a baby, you're going to be more prone to getting postpartum depression. And if you're chasing the almighty dollar, you're going to be stressed. So remember that progesterone, nature would like you to reproduce. So nature either wants you to, nature wants you to reproduce. Nature also wants the species to survive. And then nature will do whatever the species needs to do to survive. So if you need to run away from marauding invaders, or run away from a bear, or protect yourself, nature doesn't want you pregnant. So this is really cool. And I've said this before, but I'm going to repeat it. Progesterone has an easy two-step process to convert to cortisol. Cortisol is your fight or flight hormone. Cortisol puts sugar into your blood, makes your heart rate go up and your blood pressure rise, and your lungs makes you breathe harder, makes it so that you can run away from the bear, or run away from the marauding invaders, or take care of all those reports that you have due on Friday. Whatever it is. So it's going to be harder for you to conceive if you are in high cortisol, and you're not going to be able to make as much progesterone. Well, you make progesterone, but your progesterone is going to get converted to cortisol, and then you're going to be less likely to conceive. Nature is going to give you a break. If you need to run away from danger, we don't want you pregnant, because if you're pregnant, it's harder to run away from danger. But if you're happy and everything's chill and copacetic and everything's nice, then you're not going to be turning that progesterone into cortisol. You're going to have progesterone, whose job is to prepare the uterine lining for implantation, and then to maintain the uterine lining so it's a happy place for a baby to be. The first bit of progesterone is made by the corpus luteum. So when you ovulate, your follicle splits into ovum, or future potential baby, and corpus luteum. Corpus luteum, its job is to stay back in the ovary and kick out lots and lots of progesterone. And if you don't conceive, it'll poop out, and it will turn into a corpus albicans, and it'll have no more progesterone in it. And then your uterine lining won't be maintained, and then it will come out. You have your menses. If you conceive, then the corpus luteum will do the same thing. It will make progesterone until it poops out, but the placenta takes over, and then you start making more and more and more progesterone and lots of progesterone, and then you get your pregnancy glow and your pregnancy happies, and your autoimmune conditions get better, and your joints feel good, and you sit there going, yo, dude, I'm pregnant. That's right. I'm growing a baby. What are you doing? I'm growing a baby. That's right. Can you do that? I don't think
no,
so.
No, I can't.
That's right.
It's all true. I can't.
I can. And think about what it started with, these teeny little tiny cells,
cells.
And it turns into Greg.
Oh.
Is that like so amazing?
Yeah, it is kind of amazing.
Yeah.
When you look at it that way, it really is.
And we do it in our bodies.
Yeah.
That's like super awesome. That's one of our superpowers. We grow people inside us.
Well, that's why you guys are complicated.
That's right. And that's why we're very attached to our kids. And what's really weird about me is I never had a bio kid, and yet I have maternal instinct in spades.
Yeah, you do.
I'm just really, I see little baby faces and I want to love them up. I see little puppy faces. Or old puppy faces, and I want to love them up. Yeah, I have a lot of motherly characteristics, wouldn't you say?
I would say so, yes.
Yeah, so it's kind of a shame that I never had a biological child, Ron.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that I never had one.
Well, who's to blame for that?
You.
Not me. Yeah, okay. I think this is what we call a yes to your moment.
I was never in the right place at the right time. And by the time I got you, who would have been a good dad, who is a good dad. I mean, you're a good dad to Greg.
Good dad to everybody.
Everybody. But Greg, for sure. You know, you're a very good dad to Greg. Greg calls you up and he like needs dad time.
Right.
Which
we
is super cool.
We had some dad time yesterday.
Super. That's really awesome. Greg would like it. We have to go to Chicago. go to Chicago.
We do.
Yeah, we'll go to Chicago and hang out with
Greg. He'd like that. He'd like that a lot. I don't know. He's coming here in April.
Woohoo. Yay, Greg. So big shout out to, so we're talking about my stepson and Ron's son, Greg. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
And anyway, so I didn't have a baby because I just wasn't in the right place at the right time. I wasn't with the right guy at the right time. And when I found the right guy, I was 41, and you were like, you basically said, I don't want you to die.
Right.
Which
I did.
Because you were concerned about me conceiving at 41.
Which you probably wouldn't have, but the point is.
Judging from Nancy, who conceived at 46.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And she was just fine, and Marley is also just fine, pretty much.
Now, they may listen to this. Be nice.
That's true. We love Marley. But Marley is a spirited child.
They were all spirited children.
Yeah, you're right.
He's not alone.
That's true. So we'll see because both Tali and Harry are awesome now.
Right. Yeah. And they were younger at one point.
Yes, and Marley's going to grow into his awesomeness.
And they were more challenging.
Yes. And I think Marley will be awesome in his own way. I mean, with a name like Marley, how can you not be? Yeah. So.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, that's the thing that so that progesterone makes you feel really good, and progesterone is useful for helping with postpartum depression. And I think that's my opinion is that progesterone, natural progesterone, not progestin, not a progestin only pill, but natural bioidentical progesterone, in my opinion, should be the first line treatment for postpartum depression. And putting in an IUD that has progestin in it does not make sense. Okay, so that was my rant. So let's do a positive side just because I want to be like Bicycle Talk.
Oh, jeez. Right. You're following my format.
I'm following your format a little bit in a loose way.
It's okay. You can do that.
And you're all right with that?
It's a compliment.
You're not trademarked?
It's a compliment.
Copyrighted?
It's a compliment.
Okay.
I like it. Right. It's good.
So here's the positive side. The positive side today is the Storrs Farmers Market.
Yay, Storrs Farmers Market.
So we
love the Storrs Farmers Market.
No, we just went there, and it's still the indoor market right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we went there this past Saturday, and we just had a blast. And so the blasty things that happened, first of all, we hung out at Brian and Anita's at Tobacco Road, and we got veggies. I have a thing for sog paneer. Now I need to have sog paneer. We used to get it. And now, I must say that getting sog paneer at the takeout place, it's very good. That we have
it's
local
really
sog paneer.
Easy.
but we have started, or you have started making sog paneer at home.
I like the correction.
Yeah. Yeah. But the sog paneer you're making, you're using local, hyper-organic, terrific Tobacco Road spinach.
I am.
Yes, and it's amazing. So they're using spinach that has been grown meticulously with a lot of nutrition in it, and we're getting high doses of this spinach. So I feel like today. I feel
Do you?
Really, yeah. Think about it. We're eating like concentrated spinach.
And it really is.
Concentrated high-quality spinach.
It's amazing when you make it, too, because, you know, there's this huge pile of spinach that you get. You know, they're big, open leaves. You know, it's
And it cooks and, way down.
And you cook it down, and it disappears. It goes down to this little tiny amount.
So we eat the spinach concentrate with queso fresco for our... I mean, we have to find Indian cheese, but that's what we've been using for the Indian cheese, fresco.
I think Manchester is the answer.
Yeah, okay.
I'm pretty sure.
So when
I think there's a little grocery store on Main Street, I think, that's right next to an Indian restaurant.
All right.
I'll find
the cheese or we can make it, because there are recipes to make it. It's just another step.
Right. Well, I was talking to Greg last night and told him that I was in the process of making sog paneer. And he's like, oh, and he goes, where'd you find the cheese? And I said, well, we kind of didn't do it that way. We used Mexican cheese instead.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, did that work? And I said, yeah, it works. It's not the same.
It's not as authentic.
Yeah.
It's still good.
Authentic. It's still good. And
the queso fresco kind of tastes like mozzarella.
And Greg went, good to know.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering.
So he's going to give it a try now.
I'm wondering if queso fresco is really Mexican mozzarella and we should just use part skim mozzarella.
I think part skim mozzarella will be fine just because it's, you know, the idea is that you need a really mild cheese.
Or you need a stiff cheese, a cheese that's more proteiny and not so fatty.
Right.
Yeah, because it the texture, it's kind of hard. It's different than, you know, it shouldn't be too gooey. And that cheese comes out a little bit gooey. It's still delicious, but it's not exactly the right texture. There's nothing wrong with the taste, but the texture's and the texture isn't bad. It's just not authentic. It's still super delicious.
Still good. So anyway, you could put other things in. I mean, you could make it with other items.
Well, you can have sog whatever. You can have sog potato. You can have sog chicken. Chicken sog.
Tofu. Yes. You know, you could do a lot of different things.
We could have a couple of things. Mm-hmm. We could have chicken and cheese in there. Or chicken and tofu. Or tofu and cheese. That's fine, too. So, anyway, that's one thing. So, we got the spinach. We got our greens. We got all the good stuff there. There's a kombucha lady there, Karen, who's selling this kombucha.
Tell everyone what she calls. She calls it kombucha.
So nice. There's fresh kombucha there. So that's really exciting. And Diane Dorfer was there with Cobblestone Farm, and she was selling lots of squash.
And she was here.
And she was here a couple of weeks ago. That's right. Mm-hmm. And so that was nice. And we saw Dave and Monty selling Girl Scout cookies, which was sort of cute. And then we saw Andra, and they were selling them for Evie, who we didn't see. And then, of course, Culinary Delights was there, and Doug with his hot sauce. And it's just a great time. Like, we know everybody there. It's very family. We go and we schmooze. And then somebody was giving a survey from UConn about Union, so I sat down and took the survey about unions, and that was kind of fun. You know, George Bailey was there. No, George. His name is George Bailey. It's so funny. Like on It's a Wonderful Life. But he's an old Yankee, and he sells his own maple syrup and honey there. And I was praising him again because the honey that he has is very dark, which means that the bees were going and getting high flavonoid flowers. And so there's going to be more antioxidants in that honey, which is very exciting. And then Dory and Adam were there with their soap. So that was really cool. So we saw a lot of great people at the Stewart's Farmers Market. It was really fun. And farmers markets in general are a good thing. You can go to Coventry. You can go to Ellington. You can go to Willimantic. You can go to Lebanon when it opens. Coventry and Stores both have indoor markets in the winter, although Coventry did their last one. And so I'm assuming they'll do their spring markets or their summer markets starting in May. And Stores is almost the entire year, pretty much the entire year that they go. They stay outdoors through November. And then in December, they're not every week. So December through April, they're not weekly. They're just twice a month. And they're at the Buchanan Auditorium at the Mansfield Public Library. They're there twice a month all year. And they'll be, so we'll go again, I guess, I'm assuming the first on April 7th will be the next one, I think. Yep. And and there'll be two more. And then starting in May, it's every week.
They'll be outside.
They'll be outside, and it'll be in front of Town Hall again. That'll be nice.
The thing that gets me is, you know, we've been buying fake greens all winter long. I call them fake greens because they're not the same.
Yeah.
And they're not the same because, you know, when you have the real stuff again, the real thing that's actually grown here, it's hard to believe there could be a night and day difference in greens. But
there really
it
is.
Truly is. There
really
it's
is.
So much better to buy your local greens when they're ready.
Yeah.
And, you know, you find a good farmer like Brian who's able to grow 10 months out of the year outside, which is remarkable
under
in
hoops.
Itself here. You know, here in the Northeast where it's very cold.
Yeah.
And you can find somebody who can do that. It's just a pleasure.
It's tremendous. Yeah. Who lovingly tends the soil and with so much love and so much science and no spraying, nothing. And, you know, there are many farms around here that were tutored by Brian who grow with the same practices. And it's pretty incredible. So Stores, big shout out to the Stores Farmers Market. Okay, so then the next thing I wanted to talk about was I wanted to go into weight loss a little bit right now because this is an interesting time of year for weight loss, and it's something that's been coming up. I had a couple people talk to me about frustration with weight loss. And so one of the things that I hear in March is frustration with weight loss. And you know what the number one thing I'm going to tell you about weight loss in March? the number one thing I'm going to tell you is relax, chill out. Why am I going to tell you that? Because one of the things that happens in March, this is pretty funny, is you may have been eating a little bit carelessly and not getting outside to do whatever activity you like to do. And if you're somebody who's an avid cyclist like me, you're not getting outside as much. Now, you can't count me because I'm very diligent about cycling indoors. So I do my indoor classes and Ron teaches his spin classes. And sometimes I do indoor cycling on my own as well. So I'm very diligent about that. But of course, I'm less likely to get outdoors if it's too cold. And also, if I have certain goals, some of those goals are better met in a warmer environment. Like when I get outdoors, it's going to be hard to do intervals if the road conditions aren't good and it's too cold. And what I really want to do is increase my aerobic capacity and do intervals. If I do them indoors, I don't have to deal with any of that. Then there gets to a point where it's better to do the intervals outdoors when the weather and the road conditions are not as much of a hindrance. So now, in terms of the weight loss issue, the first thing I say to you, March weight losers, is relax. And why do I say this? Because what happens is people, it gets to be March. You look down at your belly and you go, oh my goodness, or you look down at the scale and you get very concerned. And then you try a couple of things that might have worked. You stop eating so much sugar, or you give up a couple of drinks, or you try a couple things, and then you don't get instant results, and you get very frustrated, and you go running to your practitioner and saying, what's wrong with me? I can't lose weight. Now, first of all, if you're an older gentleman, so if you're a senior, you know, if you're in your 50s, 60s, 70s, it's harder to lose weight than it is in your 20s, 30s, 40s. Really, it really is. And when you get into your late 40s, it becomes harder to lose weight. You're not going to get instant results. So that's why I say relax and be patient. That's the first thing. Because one of the things you don't realize is in the wintertime, you don't move as much as you do in the summer, whether you're an avid exerciser or not. For example, the example I like to give is, if it's really cold out, you're less likely to take the garbage out. You're going to take the garbage out less often. You're less likely to take the compost out because you just don't want to go out in the cold and the dark. So there's more general moving that you tend to do when the weather is nicer out. You might be working in your yard more. You might be hauling branches more. There's so many little things that you don't realize you do. You might just go for a walk to the pond because you feel like it, where you might not do that if you're if it's cold and yucky out. So you're going to wind up moving more once the weather gets better. Be aware of that. You also are going to wind up eating less naturally. Just because when it's cold out, you're going to tend to want to eat more. You're going to tend to want to, when it's cold, people eat more. That's why they make restaurants cold. And when you're in a restaurant, you're going to be more likely to sit there and eat whatever they put in front of you. And you're more likely to sit there and spend more money and eat food. Whereas when it's nicer out, you don't feel like eating as much. So your weight's going to naturally come down at least a bit. Now, if you actually put effort into it, your body's going to fight you a little bit, at least at first. And it fights you at first for a few reasons. One reason is if you've been eating a little more starch and sugar, if you haven't been exercising as much, it takes time for whatever change you make in your eating to take effect. When you have fat on your body, one of the things, fat is not inert matter. Fat has hormones in it. One of the things fat has is insulin. Insulin causes fat storage. And so if your insulin is higher, you're going to store more fat. So if you're eating more starch and sugar, your insulin is going to tend to be higher. And you're going to have more fat storage. So if yesterday you started taking a lot of carbs out of your diet, your insulin and your hormones have to catch up with that. And sometimes it doesn't take 3 days. And if you are very frustrated because after a week, you've either lost no weight or maybe a pound after doing a lot of hard work changing your diet, give it time. That's one of the things to do, is to give it time and make your changes gradually. And you will probably get some results. It's not what you do inside of a week that's going to make a difference in your fat loss efforts. It's the changes you make that sustain over time. Another question I got asked is, well, what about alcohol? I was drinking, you know, 3 drinks a day, and now I went down to 1 or 2, and it's a lot less calories. It's only 200 or 300 calories from alcohol, and I'm eating a reasonable amount of calories during the day. Why am I not losing weight? So this is a big topic. The first topic here is it is alcohol specifically, and then the whole topic of a calorie is not a calorie is not a calorie. Let's remember what a calorie is. A calorie is a unit of heat. And when you're talking about a calorie, calories with respect to food and how we lose weight, you're really talking about a kilocalorie. You're talking about 1,000 calories, because a calorie is the amount of heat needed to raise 1 milliliter of water 1 degree Celsius. That's all it is. But when you're talking about calories in food, you're talking about kilocalories. Number two, you're talking about the amount of heat needed to burn a particular food to ash. That's what calories are based on. It's not based on how it behaves in your body. So different foods behave differently in your body, regardless of how many calories they have. You could eat the same calories of 2 different foods, and on one food you would lose weight and one food you would gain weight because of how they behave in your body and how they stimulate your hormones. So I'll use the metabolic effect metaphor that I have often used. So I heard Keone T to say this first, but if you have 200 calories of chicken breast versus 200 calories of donut, which one do you think is going to be more of a fat loss food? That should be pretty obvious. It's going to be the chicken breast.
But donuts taste good.
Yes, they do. But the donuts are going to raise your insulin a lot more than the chicken breast is going to. Chicken breast is going to be pure. Now, not the chicken breast is going to raise your insulin some, but not nearly as much as the donut. And the donut is going to raise your insulin so much that it's going to pull sugar out of your blood. And what do you want after you have 100 calories of donut?
100 calories of donut. Another donut.
Yes. What do you want to have after you have 100 calories of chicken breast?
Oh, yeah. You're probably pretty full.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. They satiate you in different ways.
I see where you're going here.
The other piece is that when you eat protein, when you eat the same calories of protein versus the same calories of carbs, carbs are going to be used either as fuel now or they're going to be stored as glycogen. And if you don't use, and if you eat too many carbs, carbs are the most easily stored as fat. They're going to be converted first to triglycerides and then they're going to be stored as fat. They raise your insulin. Your insulin drives them into the cells as needed, and whatever doesn't get driven into the cells gets converted to fat. And so you need to lower your insulin, and that apparatus has to be changed. So if you make a change now, it's going to take time for your body to readjust all of your hormones so that you're now in a more of a fat-burning zone. Now, the question of alcohol specifically, why is it that, you know, I drop down to only a couple hundred calories a day of alcohol and I'm not losing weight? Well, that has to do with alcohol specifically. Now, yes, alcohol has calories, but that's not the only issue. The issue is that when your body looks at alcohol, it sees it and it goes, oh, this is poison. We have to get this out of our body now. So the body has alcohol dehydrogenase, and it has enzymes that break down the alcohol, takes it from alcohol down to carbon dioxide and water. And there's a process that it has to go through. And one of the steps that it goes through is aldehyde. So aldehyde, the nature doesn't like aldehydes very much. So aldehydes are unstable, and they're likely to lose electrons and cause free radical damage. And there you have your hangover. But in any case, if you're drinking alcohol, your body looks at it and your liver looks at it and goes, oh boy, we got to get rid of this yesterday. And remember, the liver is this big organ that has all these cells. Every single cell is like every other cell, but all those cells do a bazillion different things. It's an amazing organ. Okay. And so if it sees alcohol, it's going to go ahead and spit out alcohol dehydrogenase, and it's going to work on breaking that down because your body doesn't want that alcohol in there because your body thinks the alcohol is bad for you, and too much alcohol is bad for you. So it's going to, your liver is going to be primarily getting rid of that alcohol. So it's not going to be as available to store the carbs you ate as glycogen to convert your glycogen into fuel. And in the periphery, carbs you eat are going to be turned into fat. That they're going to be turned into fat in your blood by way of insulin because the liver's not as available to manage them because it's working on the alcohol. Of course, if you drink too much alcohol, some of your liver cells are going to die. And I have to wonder, now when you have real liver cell death, you'll see elevated liver enzymes and you'll see scarring. But I have to wonder if you drink some alcohol every day, if there's some silent liver cell death that we don't see on lab forms that, you know, when you see your ALT and AST, your liver enzymes, they don't necessarily rise. And is there some cell death that's minute? And that if you had more well-functioning liver cells, would you lose more weight? And that when you insult your liver with alcohol regularly, when you're trying to lose weight, your liver is just not going to be as on board to manage your metabolism. So how much alcohol can you drink and lose weight? Guess what? How much of anything can you eat and lose weight? That's it, very individual. There are people who can drink a couple of drinks a day and be skinny. If that's not you, if you are in a place where you're having trouble losing weight and you, one of the things you're doing is you're drinking two or three drinks a day, you got to take a look at that because I'll tell you, you're probably going to lose more weight the less alcohol you drink. Now, my buddy Aaron Russ, who's done some lovely training with me, he told me that three drinks a week is the sweet spot. If you drink three drinks a week, then your performance is pretty safe. But more than three drinks a week, it's going to affect your physical activity performance.
A week. We're not talking about a day here.
I am talking about a week. Three drinks a week. That's a general principle.
Wow.
Now, it could be different for different people. I don't know. But more than three drinks a week, now your liver is compromised enough that it's not going to metabolize as efficiently. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So he has clients who like to drink. They like their wine, and they like their wine most nights. And he would explain that to them, and they would get annoyed. And then I have other patients who are like, but I like my wine. I need to drink my, their wine is like their blankie. So you have people who range from, you know, I have a glass of wine at night, at one glass of wine at night. And, you know, they're not really alcoholics. One glass of wine a day doesn't really qualify as alcoholism, I suppose, unless it's hurting you and you're doing it anyway. But if you're happy and healthy and you're drinking that alcohol, if it affects your exercise performance, that's not such a big deal. As long as, you know, you're drinking that glass of wine and you're eating healthy otherwise and you're just generally healthy, it still might affect your exercise performance, but in the scheme of things, if it makes you happy, so what? But in terms of fat loss, it's not helping your case. People who help people lose weight will tell you that alcohol is not entirely your friend in terms of fat loss. And beer is a very large culprit there. Beer in particular tends to raise that insulin, and it's not just the alcohol that's in the beer, that there are components in the beer, probably the level of carbs that raise your insulin, and they're just made very bioavailable. So they raise your insulin, and that's why, you know, men have the classic beer belly when they drink a lot of beer. That, and they're gaining it in a way where they're having an insulin dysregulation issue. Conversely, we know people who stopped drinking beer and lost, large amounts of weight.
My cousin.
Yeah.
30 plus pounds. Just
right.
Gave up beer, stopped.
And that's it. All he did.
That's it?
Yeah.
It's the only change he made.
It was the beer.
Yeah, it was the beer.
Yeah.
It was the beer. So. And it was right in the
midsection. His belly. So right, that's belly. That's an insulin response.
Yep. So I have to throw this out there because, you know, we have to have that point counterpoint thing. Okay. You ever hear of a guy by the name of Frank Shorter? You remember that name?
Yeah. He was a runner?
He won, in 1972, he won the Olympic marathon.
Okay.
He drank two pints of beer before he ran the race.
Okay. That's
fine. He was kind of known as being a heavy drinker.
Okay.
But he was also an Olympic marathon.
So,
you know, everybody's different, but
that's true.
And then the question is, would he have been better?
So people who are happy and healthy, they have no obvious physical deficits. Their hemoglobin A1C is great. They're not overweight. They're happy. They're healthy. By all accounts, their body is functioning well. Their liver enzymes are good. Their triglycerides are good. And they're drinking one or two drinks a day. What am I going to tell them? Nothing. They're fine. But if you're coming to me and you're saying, I'm trying to lose weight, and you're clearly a little bit or a lot overweight, and you're drinking a couple of drinks a day, and it's not, and you're not losing weight, that's one of the things I'm going to talk to you about because it's affecting you. So, and the other thing that I have to mention, and again, thanks to Jay Tita for saying this to me, is weight loss is neither linear, fair, nor predictable. And I said that to a patient recently, and they said, I don't like that. Yeah, me neither. Nobody does. It's not linear in that you can do everything right. And just because it's not calories in, calories out. If you eat this many calories, you're going to lose this many pounds. It doesn't just happen because there's so many other things that affect it. It's what chemicals you've been exposed to, what hormones you've been exposed to. Stress is a huge effector of your ability to lose weight because stress raises your cortisol, puts sugar into your blood, and makes it harder to lose weight. People who retire lose weight. People who go on vacation lose weight without changing their diets very much. I mean, and the amount of weight can vary, but when you take huge stressors out of your life by going on vacation or by retiring, it's easier to lose weight. You have to look at all those other factors. Fair, it's like, but I did everything I was supposed to. Why am I not losing weight? Well, because it's not fair, because your body has some agenda that you're not entirely tapping into. Predictable, again, the same thing. You're not, just because you do everything that's supposedly right doesn't mean that something's going to happen. And just because you follow X diet doesn't mean you're going to get good results. So, again, shouting out to Jaden Keone, is that you want to be a detective instead of a dieter, and you want to figure out what is going to work for you.
And you know about that stress thing?
Yes.
You know how else you can lose weight?
Say that again?
Do you know how else you can lose weight?
By de-stressing.
Gentle yoga.
Yeah.
Because it takes the stress out.
Takes your cortisol down. That's exactly. Right. Anything that reduces your cortisol is going to help you with fat loss. All right. So that was my rant. So you've been listening to 91.7 FM WHUS Doors. I am Fran Storch. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath. And this is a call and talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch with my co-host Ron Meniza. And you can write me at any time at radionaturopath@gmail.com if you'd like to listen to the show at another time. We've got podcasts at whus.org. You can also check out my Facebook page at FranStorchND, Twitter at the same handle. And we are also streamed on iTunes. And we will be back next week here on Radio Naturopath, where my special guest will be Eagle Moon Rays talking about hypnotherapy. And we hope that you enjoy the beginning of April. So we will be with you next week. All right. So this has been 91.7 FM WHUS Doors.